The Tom Woods Show, episode 1467.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you believe in homeschooling, but you also believe in not running yourself ragged and in maintaining your mental health, then you need the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum, for which I made 400 videos on history and government. Get it from me, and I'll throw in three exclusive, unbelievable bonuses you can't get anywhere else. How do you get it through me? Head over to ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. Final episode of Brian McClanahan Week. Brian holds a PhD in history from the University of South Carolina. He is the host of The Brian McClanahan Show. Brian spelled B-R-I-O-N. Check out his podcast. Today, I thought we would talk about the period of history other than the founding period, which later became Brian's favorite. The period of history that was his favorite for a long time, because it's a favorite of mine as well, and I thought we would comment on it a little bit. Now, I haven't, as I'm recording this right now, I haven't decided what I'm going to title this episode, and for all I know, the title is absolutely going to give away the punchline here. So for all I know, you're rolling your eyes saying, Woods, we already know what his favorite period of history is. Will you just get on with it already? So I guess I'll do that. Brian, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Appreciate it.
All right, so it's the last day of Brian McClanahan Week, so we're going to do something... We decided to do something that no one's expecting. And no, we're not going to talk about music because I don't want to embarrass you by having your musical taste become known. So instead, how'd you like that? See, by the end of the week, yeah. I'm just ready to hang it up and go relax for the weekend. But instead, we're going to talk about a topic that I think will surprise people, because you were saying to me at one point, if I were to tell people my favorite period of history, let's say up until you came to decide that it was the founding period, they would probably be surprised. So I said, well, what was it? And what was your answer?
Well, my answer was the Russian Revolution. It's not something that people would say, well, it's probably the war. No, I mean, I like the war. But when I first got interested in history, I was a young wee lad. Of course, I talked about Williamsburg in the first episode, but then there was a teacher I had in eighth grade. And he showed us this film in class. And this is a time when you would still get, you go and you had the film projector, right? So you have the big reels on there. You show up in class and you're, yeah, we got film today. And the film was Nicholas and Alexandra. And he showed the last part of the film. And that got me hooked on the Russian Revolution. I just could not read enough about this thing. Because the last part of the film, of course, is the assassination of the Tsar and his wife and his family. And it's such a great cinematography. It's so good. The film came out in 1971. And you know what's going to happen, but you're still cringing when it does because it's so powerfully done. And I thought, wow, I mean, there's something to these commies out there. These guys are terrible. And so, of course, this is still in the period of the Cold War. We're still, you know, it's right around the time we had films like Red Dawn and Rocky IV and all that stuff. So, I mean, I was into that too. It's like, yeah, Rocky IV, go punch a commie. So I thought this stuff was just great. I really wanted to learn more about the Russian Revolution, where it came from, why it's important. You know, you have these last days of the Tsar, this last aristocracy in so many ways, this real aristocracy in Russia. And I find it fascinating. And I think that if more people knew about that period, they would absolutely love it. It's tragic. It's got everything. It's got every element you can think of in a really good story. It's all encompassed in that Russian Revolution. So I know you like it too, and I just find it fascinating.
I do. I've done an episode or two on it, and the details of it are fascinating to me. The person who most influenced the way I think about it, I guess it would be two. One is Richard Pipes, mm-hmm. who was an advisor to Reagan. Mm-hmm. And the other, because he wrote a multi-volume series on the years leading up to the revolution, and then the revolution itself, and then the aftermath. And then he condensed that down into a single volume for people who just haven't got the time to do that. And I always recommend this one, A Concise History of the Russian Revolution is what it's called. I always recommend that book. In fact, let me jot that down to make sure I link to it at tomwoods.com/1467. Link to that. It's a great book. It reads like fiction, mm-hmm. You know, so you're really absorbed by it. But the other person would be the person who taught it to me in college, and that was Vladimir Brovkin, who's not there anymore. But he was one of the Russian Jews who was allowed to emigrate to the U.S. under the special deal that was reached in the 1970s. And he was a scholar of the Mensheviks, which were the other Marxists who, you know, were not in, let's say, Lenin's favor. And so he wrote a book called The Mensheviks After October. Like, what happened to these people after the Russian Revolution? Perfectly good question. But he was extremely anti-Soviet. I mean, extreme. He even said that at Yalta, the West sold out Eastern Europe to the communists. I mean, he was shouting this from the podium in the classroom. So he wasn't making any pretense at impartiality on that sort of stuff. But then he came in one day and said, "Today I am going to refute what I call the good Lenin, bad Stalin myth that we have, that Lenin was good and idealistic and there were a lot of great things that happened. And then mysteriously, Stalin, whom he had known very well, took over this thing and everything became terrible." So it doesn't occur to them, first of all, I mean, the point that he wanted to make was that Lenin was a terrible person too.
Oh, yeah.
But even if Lenin had been a great person, the fact that he presides over a system that could be so easily turned into what Stalin made it should say something about him, you know, just even that.
Right.
What is it in particular that you love about this? Oh, although if you want to comment on that, feel free.
Well, no, I mean, first of all, when you say Lenin, anybody that thinks that Lenin was a good, I mean, you have the Cheka, you have the Red Terror, which is going on during the Civil War. I mean, there's all kinds of things to look at what Lenin was doing that were just despicable. I mean, even the fact that the family was assassinated on the order of the Politburo. I mean, this came from the top down. So, and now for years they tried to sell that off. No, we didn't have any role. But they did. I mean, everyone knows now that came from the top. It came from Lenin to kill the family. But I think it's the tragedy of the entire thing. You know, the missteps. You can certainly have sympathy with people in the period leading up to the revolution and some of the things, you know, Bloody Sunday and some of those activities that went on that were certainly awful. And of course, the Russo-Japanese War, fighting over Korea. I mean, how ridiculous is that? And people were wondering about it. Why are we where the heck is Korea? Right? You got this peninsula. I mean, who cares about that if you're over in Moscow? Where the heck is Korea and who cares? So you certainly have this, that part of it. I mean, you've got this, maybe this little anti-war undertone going there. Of course, you have the abuse of power from the central authority. So you can certainly sympathize with a powder keg brewing in Russia. And then, of course, without the safety valve in a legislature, though they were given one eventually, and then of course Nicholas shut it down. Then there's the period leading up to that. You know, you have the other czars before Nicholas, and I like that too. You know, you've got the slogan of orthodoxy, autocracy, and nationalism. This whole thing, we're going to be Russians and good Russians, and we're going to have a strong central government. And how we're going to, and you have the Montesquieu position. Can a decentralized or can a legislature work in a country like Russia? The tragedy of everything, where you have the family simply whisked away, and then you know, eventually assassinated the way they were. I just find all of that so interesting. And the details of how that happened. I mentioned the film. In the film that I think everyone should see, Nicholas and Alexandra, the last part of the film, the family, as we know, was sent down to a room in the home that they were being sequestered in. And they were shot to death against a wall. And I'm sure a lot of people have seen the picture of that. But in the film, they do it perfectly. And they don't have everyone that was actually there at the time. They have it scaled down for the film. But while they're sitting there, there's no sound in the room except the clock ticking on the wall. That's it. They're looking at each other. The door's open, and there's no sound when the door's open. There's no screams. It's just the clock ticking on the wall, like the last seconds of their life ticking away. It's so powerful. And I think that part of it, too, always attracted me to the revolution. Of course, then the aftermath. I mean, what happened with the creation of the Soviet Union, how that affected foreign policy for decades in the United States in general, and other parts of the world. You know, you have the communist revolution spreading around the world and how important that was. So there's just so many things to like as far as from a historical standpoint and looking at, you know, cause and effect in modern politics and history.
Also, just watching the steps by which the revolution goes from at least plausibly something that could benefit people, which is how they portrayed themselves. They did not say, we're going to establish a one-party totalitarian state that's going to do the, you know, obviously they didn't say that. Mm-hmm. But to watch that unfold step by step, that there was an assembly that was a legislative assembly that was elected, that Lenin had accused the previous government of not ever intending to hold the elections. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, this is pretty rich of him to say that. So they do actually hold it, and the Bolsheviks don't win a majority. So it's allowed to meet for like 10 minutes, and then they shut it down. That's the end of it. And to watch the way it happened, the way it unfolded, the war on the churches that takes place. It's interesting. Obviously, Catholics are in a minority in Orthodox Russia, but there was a war on the Catholic Church where the valuables like the chalices and other precious metal items in the churches were in the sights of Lenin, because he was saying that we need to take these things and melt them down and sell them to get money for famine relief. Mm-hmm. And so we know, because the churches are enemies of the people, we need to take their valuables. And there are stories of priests, you know, trying to bar the door so that the valuables couldn't be taken. And you have photographs of Russian soldiers walking out, holding statues and stuff, taking them from the churches. But Lenin isn't going to spend this for disaster, you know, for famine relief. The famine relief will come from Herbert Hoover in the West.
Right.
He's going to spend it on weapons and stuff. I mean, it's just like straight out of an Orwell novel. My favorite thing, by the way, that's in the Richard Pipes book is they tried to really, really make the culture be a culture of the working man. And so mm-hmm. instead of the old fashioned orchestra with the wind instruments and the string instruments, instead they would have orchestral productions of factory whistles and factory noises. And so they tried to do this, but the problem was no one could tell what the hell music it was. Like no one could, so they had to, I mean, it was that stupid. I mean, it was really that ideologically bizarre what was going on.
Yeah, I mean, you can't make this stuff up. But of course, it all fits. And I would say that if you look at Western civilization, it all goes back to the French Revolution. It all fits with that because it was happening in the French Revolution. We're going to radically restructure everything. You know, the church is going to be now in France, it was the Church of Reason, right? And then, of course, in Russia, the church has become the Museum of Atheism, right? So you got to have that. But I think it all makes sense. We're gonna restructure society entirely. And the thing I love about it is that when people talk about these things today, and it's all, oh, that's just slippery slope analogy. It's never going to happen here. That can't happen in the United States because we're just so against communism, none of that stuff would happen. Are you sure? I mean, you look at what's going on in the arts and other things, you can see that there are strains of this in the United States, and it's all ties back to that revolutionary period. But you know, when you talk about the Lenin marching off with gold, and I mean, it was essentially a Roman policy: enrich the soldiers and scorn all others. I mean, that was the point of the Roman Empire. By the time you get to the Severan Dynasty, so it's all totalitarianism. I think that it's just a modern manifestation of it, and it's fascinating, as you said, to see how this stuff goes from incremental change, and then just, I mean, it's just overblown. Everything just gets blown up, and then you have this horrible government that nobody knows what to do with, and it takes, 80 years or so for it to all fall apart.
There are some really, really blood-curdling quotations from Lenin that you can find where somebody says, I forget which person it was who was speaking to him, but there was some institution within the government or some agency, and it was like the commissariat for blah, 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 blah. But basically, its purpose was to execute dissidents. And so an advisor of some sort said to Lenin, we should call it the commissariat for social extermination. And Lenin said, yeah, we should, but we, obviously we can't.
Right.
I mean, yeah. Just very, very blunt about all this. And of course, the rage he has, he's like Marx in this respect, of anyone who disagrees with him, even marginally. I mean, most people wouldn't even be able to tell the difference between Lenin and half his opponents. And he would denounce that just the way Marx did. I mean, Marx spent so much of his time, instead of, spending his early years writing his systematic treatise, he spends it responding to complete nobodies. You know, like it's like he's so hypersensitive. He has to respond even to a complete nobody who's tracked against Marxism nobody read or who was disagreeing with him 10%, and so he'll smash these things. Lenin was very much the same way. I mean, he cannot bear criticism, and it's not just that, well, we have an honorable disagreement. It's that these are just our absolute enemies, and they need to be wiped out. It's just blood-curdling.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at ideology, and I think this is something that's important too, and why I like the Russian Revolution, and because of the interest in ideology and how dangerous ideology can actually be. And one of the things we talked about on this week was, you know, where do I fit politically? And one of the things that I've always thought was dangerous is ideology in general. I'm not an ideologue. I simply like tradition. I like the things that have come before, and we have examples. I mean, this is, so you look at examples and you say, okay, show me where you talk to the lefties, the progressives or the comp, show me where this thing has actually ever worked out well. Is there any example, anyone? And of course, they all say, what about Scandinavia? Well, as you've pointed out many times, that doesn't even work there. But show me where this ideology that you have actually works. An example, in practice, and we can talk about it, but they can't. And so it always has to go to that point where you start really oppressing people or abusing people to get what you want. And I think that's one of the lasting effects of the Russian Revolution. And we should be looking at that, but we don't. So if we could get anything out of it, it would be that the danger of ideology in politics, and why tradition should be much more important when we're talking about things ideas in society. I mean, this is what Patrick Henry said, you know, experience is my only guide. John Dickinson, experience is my only guide. Reason may mislead us. Or Patrick Henry in his Illusion of Hope, when he pointed out, when he said, I have but one lamp by which my feet are guided, and that is experience. So we have experience versus Russia, which is ideology, which is awful. And that's always been a draw to me as well.
You could say, though, that maybe the problems in Russia were just so entrenched that you couldn't have an evolutionary Burkean solution. You needed some kind of dramatic rupture. Maybe somebody could say that.
Possibly. But I mean, look, when there was attempt at reform before Nicholas II, and the idiots who blew him up, right? I mean, Nicholas's grandfather was trying to institute a Duma. He was trying to do things, and they blew him up on a bridge. I mean, so this is the ideologues working against. I mean, ultimately they're going to get what they want, but I mean, this is where you could have had a solution. It was there. But when you get ideology and it becomes so blinded by what you have to maybe have an incremental change here and there, it creates that kind of environment. So I think that, Russia, maybe it took something like that. But I mean, are we going to – I find that to be hard to believe, that something couldn't have been done to make it better. I mean, look, Nicholas was willing to abdicate and have a constitutional system. I mean, we had that under the Mensheviks for a time. The Mensheviks made the mistake in keeping World War I going. If they didn't, this is where we get back to war again too. If there's no World War I the way it was working, then there would have been, I think the Russian Revolution never happens. So war is a disaster. That's the other part of this thing that I like about it too. And maybe that Duma with the Mensheviks in charge would have been able to keep the Bolsheviks at bay. And not allow them to take power. I don't know. I mean, it's a what if that we'll never know.
It's interesting that Edmund Burke, talks about the problems with the French Revolution and it having been a radical break instead of an organic evolution from the past. Mm-hmm. And he contrasts that with the history of his own country. But it's like what was there? No English Civil War where the king was executed? Right. There's a small detail.
Well, sure. But I mean, at the end of the day, what happens though? I mean, that government only lasts for a very brief time and then it's booted out again because the people didn't, they wanted to be able to dance.
Yeah,
they wanted to be able to dance and listen to music. And they didn't like, the Puritan, the no fun Puritans now controlling everything in society. So I think that in that way, you know, you had that reaction to it, that conservative reaction. They got rid of those people and you went back to what it was before. But with, of course, then you had the bloodless revolution and the glorious revolution of 1688, which did change things. So, I mean, it's possible. I don't know. I mean, this could be a big topic we could talk about. Can you have change without bloodshed? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And bloodshed, you just never know where it's going to take you. Now, we're getting to the end of Brian McClanahan Week, and I haven't really asked you, even though we did do an episode about you, I haven't really asked you to just flat out describe your politics, because you are not, you don't come out and say, I'm a libertarian, I'm a conservative, I'm a this or that. You seem like somebody who just believes in the system established by the framers, and you know, you'll take that where it takes you. But I am curious because apparently even some of your own listeners sometimes have trouble trying to pin you down on exactly what and who you are. So how would you describe your politics?
Well, I used to say, and actually this is something I try to do on purpose, because I don't want to be pigeonholed one way or another. I like to have some intellectual flexibility. It's not that I don't believe in things. It's just that, you know, I'm not someone who I like to talk about ideas. But I have always said that I'm an American traditionalist. And I remember years ago I said that, and Gutzman's piped in. What the heck does that mean? That's Kevin Gutzman likes to do.
That's Kevin right there.
Yeah. What the heck does that mean? So I believe, as you said, in the tradition that was established with federalism, I do believe in republicanism with a lowercase r. That would be how I would describe myself. I don't like the term paleoconservative because I don't think it really fits me all the time. I don't like the term paleolibertarian because I don't think it fits me all the time either. I do think there is a necessity of state action at times. So, I mean, I'm not an anarchist, but I'm someone who certainly believes in the founding tradition of decentralization, of federalism, and of the necessity of communities to be able to direct their own affairs. So I believe in if whatever tradition you have in your local area, you can go with that. As far as my area, I mean, I might want some things that people wouldn't want somewhere else, but that's for my little community to decide. And I'm not an imperialist either culturally, politically, or militarily. I think that we should live and let live. I mean, that, if I had to put it at, we should live and let live. And that way, I think that we would all get along so much better. It's just that it seems like people just can't do that.
Brent, I want to take just a minute to talk to the folks here. I've got a lot of people who listen to this program who are just burned out. They're burned out by work. They're burned out by parenting. Whatever it is, they're just overwhelmed. And they feel like they can't catch up and they can't catch their breath and their mental health is suffering and their physical health is suffering and they just don't see a way out. Now, I have a potential solution that may be outside your comfort zone, but I want you to try it anyway. And that's the Simple Habit Meditation app. It's a 2018 Google Play Award winner for standout well-being app. It's got over 65,000 five-star reviews, and it's just what you want. It's got short meditations you can consume in 5 minutes. You can be doing them on the go, so you don't have to set aside 45 minutes and sit in a lotus position. Hundreds of meditations are available for free, and thousands with the premium membership. Well, you head over to simplehabit.com/woods and you can get 30% off the premium subscription. That's an amazing deal. Simplehabit.com/woods gets you 30% off the premium subscription. Again, I know this may be outside your comfort zone, but if that voice in your head is telling you you need this, then you need it. Check it out, simplehabit.com/woods. As we finish Brian McClanahan Week, let's take a little time for you to recommend for people the books you would be very happy if everybody read. Maybe three or four books that would thrill you.
Wow.
If people actually read them.
If everybody read three, wow. That's a very good question.
Let's leave aside, let's just for the sake of it, let's leave aside McClanahan and Woods books.
Right,
just
okay.
We take that for granted.
I mean, yeah, that's okay. For granted. So I won't list that. You know, if I had to pick, if we're going to different periods, let's say we're going to the middle America period because that's when people want to listen to me for that. So I would recommend they read Avery Craven's The Coming of the Civil War. It's a have you read Craven's? Have you read that book, Tom?
I'm sorry to say I haven't. I've always meant to.
Okay. Well, I mean it's okay. I mean it's such a fantastic. First of all, Craven's from the blundering generation school. So he thought that all these people just we could have avoided the war if just cooler heads had prevailed. There's actually a theory, I don't know if you've heard this, but if William Seward had been elected over Lincoln, we wouldn't have had the war. Have you ever heard this? There's actually I believe there's a book on this now. I can't remember the title of it, but Seward would have avoided the war because he was a known quantity and he would have been able to work with the South and maybe even gotten the Union back. So that's interesting. But Craven is of this idea. First of all, he has one of my favorite lines in any history book I've ever read. About the United States. It's the 19th century was the era of sweaty people. I love that line. Because you just think about it. I mean, we talked about air conditioning, how hard these people worked. No matter where you were, how hard it was. And I think the book is fantastic. It gets into this idea of, you know, what really caused the war. He's not necessarily, he's not pro-South. He's not pro-North. He's very interested in a very objective look at what's going on. And I find that book great. Albion Seed by David Hackett Fisher. Everyone should read that book.
I did read that one.
Yeah, that's, I mean, when you look at American history, colonial history, it's a cultural history. So again, it's not one of these that if you're into wars and politics, it's not that. But it describes how these four British folkways were so different from each other in British North America, and how you had the Puritans and the Quakers in the north, and you had these Cavaliers and Celts in the south, and how even then they didn't see eye to eye on virtually anything. And so this is why federalism would have worked, because, and they all mentioned it, we can't have a central government because we have all these different cultures and things, and they talked about this incessantly. And so we don't need a central authority to tell the Cavaliers telling the Puritans how to live and vice versa. It just doesn't need to happen. So I find that book fascinating. Let's see. Another one, if I could just pick one.
I can give you a minute to think.
Well, I think one that would be good if you're interested in the South, Bradford's Remembering Who We Are, which is a collection of essays. It's about Southern conservatism and just the South in general. Bradford is fantastic. If you can read anything by Mel Bradford, I would recommend it. We haven't talked about Mel Bradford, but it's very good. Richard Weaver's The Southern Tradition at Bay is very good.
That's a great book.
Yeah. And he's not, the thing about Weaver, he's critical of the South at times. You know, he's not necessarily someone who's saying the South is always right. He's critical when he needs to be. And I think that's good. That's four. Let's see.
By the way, when I read that book, it made me feel bad about myself because that was his PhD dissertation.
Yes.
And it reads like a book that took 40 years of learning to put together.
Right.
And I thought, geez, what hope is there for me? My dissertation's a piece of crap compared to this.
Yeah, I know. Mine's a political biography of James Byard. And I mean, it's just not nowhere near as good. I mean, it's just citing letters. And Richard Weaver writes this tremendous, almost a manifesto, right, for his dissertation. It's amazing.
But it's like he's read everything. Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. Those four would be very good if you just wanted to read something and just go, okay, we're going to start there. Anything by Forrest MacDonald. In fact, one of my favorite Forrest MacDonald books is his book, it's very short, The Presidency of Thomas Jefferson. Here's a Hamiltonian writing a book on Thomas Jefferson, and he does an awesome job with it. I mean, he of course, because he's Forrest MacDonald, but he even says at the beginning, I'm a Hamiltonian, I don't really like Jefferson, but he wrote a very nice history of Jefferson's presidency. It's very
good. I didn't know that. I knew he'd written the book, but I assumed it was critical.
Well, he's critical, but he's not overly critical. So it's good. And I find it a good introduction to Jefferson's presidency. It's a quick read. It's not hard to get through. And it's fantastic. That would be, we could talk about this for a while. You put me on the spot there.
Well, no. Look, that's great. Look, you gave me five books. Yeah. That's more than I asked for. That's fine.
Okay. Yeah. I mean,
no need to reproach yourself here.
Yeah. Oh, one more. If you had to pick from a mainstream historian, James McPherson's For Cause and Comrades. If you're interested in the war, and of course, again, I'm assuming this, you know, the war for Southern independence, as I like to call it. If you're interested in that war, then that book gets into what those men on both sides were fighting for, and you find that it's not necessarily what you think. And this is James McPherson, who is not by any means a pro-Southern historian. I mean, he really doesn't like the South. But he had to follow the evidence, and he said, look, I can't find... there are Southerners who fought for slavery, but most of them did not. They were fighting for the founding fathers. They were fighting for liberty. They were fighting for the Constitution. These are the things they talked about. So, I can't find where you have this overarching thing where it's just slavery, slavery, and slavery. And this is James McPherson. It's not like it's somebody on the South writing about this. This is a mainstream as you can get when it comes to the war, who's coming to those conclusions. So I'd recommend that one too.
All right. We're going to have all these listed at tomwoods.com/1467. Remember the Brian McClanahan Show and all things Brian McClanahan you can find out about at brianmcclanahan.com. That's Brian with an O. I'll link to all the Brian stuff at tomwoods.com/1467, including his outstanding McClanahan Academy, where you're going to learn an awful lot of stuff you're not going to learn otherwise. And you can take 25% off with coupon code WOODS. At this point, anything you see that has a coupon code window, you might as well try Woods. You never know. Maybe I advertised for them at one time or another. You might as well try Woods. It can't hurt. And and it works for the McClanahan Academy, too. Well, listen, Brian, you just spent 5 days with my listening audience and me. And I think it's been great and a lot of fun. But it's a major time commitment for you. I mean, you're even during the summer, you're always at work, and you're a busy guy. And we're all grateful to you for doing this. Thanks so much.
Well, Tom, I appreciate you having me on for the whole week. It's really been fun. So I hope your listeners got something out of it, and they head on over to the Brian McClanahan Show. I'd love to see him over there.
All right, folks, that's going to do it for Brian McClanahan Week. I hope you've enjoyed Brian McClanahan Week. I want to tell you, for those of you who wish you could have gone on the Contra Cruise this year, the cruise Bob Murphy and I host every year. We have a lot of fun doing that, and people on board have a lot of fun. We are having another one in 2020, but we won't be promoting it for a little while because it's so far off. Normally, we do it in October. This is the first time we've done it in July. That was because it's Alaska, and October is outside the cruising season for Alaska. So that means it's over a year until the next one. So we will be promoting it, you know, some months down the road. But if you want to be able to save the date and you really, really want to plan ahead, I just want you to know that Contra Cruise 2020, the fifth one, will take place October 17th through the 24th of 2020. And we have confirmed Scott Horton as special guest on board that cruise. That is going to be unbelievable. Scott was a special guest on the second Contra Cruise, and it was so ridiculously memorable. He was such an amazing addition to that cruise. He went above and beyond anything Bob or I expected of him in terms of staying up late with people and interacting with people and taking part in things and just being the all-around great guy we know he is. And he's going to be joining us once again. I could not be more delighted to announce that. So just keep that in the back of your mind. October 17th through the 24th of 2020, it's going to be an Eastern Caribbean itinerary, which we have not yet done. And it's going to be wonderful. So do please plan ahead and think about that. And I'll see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free. And we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.